We have a story of very personal diplomacy. President Trump has been texting world leaders, and they have been texting him.
In one message, Trump told Norway's prime minister that he's trying to seize Greenland in part because he did not receive a Nobel Peace Prize. That was Trump's explanation for shaking the most important U.S. alliance and disrupting the world order. Overnight, Trump shared messages he received. One comes from France's president, who tries flattery on Trump but then raises the issue of Greenland and proposes to discuss it over dinner.
Now world leaders meet face-to-face at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland. NPR White House correspondent Danielle Kurtzleben is covering all this. Danielle, good morning.
Hey, good morning.
What's the U.S. delegation doing in Europe?
Well, today, Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent will be speaking in Davos. Then Trump is scheduled to talk on Wednesday. And then on Thursday, there's what the White House is calling a charter announcement for the Board of Peace that Trump created to oversee reconstruction in Gaza after the conflict he's been trying to end between Israel and Hamas. In terms of substance, we don't know much yet. White House economic advisor Kevin Hassett has suggested that Trump will unveil a new housing policy. Beyond that, we know he likes to talk about tariffs. And days ago, he threatened to tariff goods from 8 European countries until the U.S. has a deal to acquire Greenland.
Okay, thank you for raising that. For those who didn't follow the news over the holiday, what were these threats about tariffs?
Well, Trump posted that he's going to impose 10% tariffs on those 8 countries starting on February 1st. Then raise it to 25% in June. That is, until a Greenland deal happens. Now, we don't really know details here. I've asked the White House, for example, what law would even authorize this, and I haven't received word yet. But those European countries, meanwhile, they're all NATO members, and they've all said they stand in full solidarity with fellow NATO member Denmark, as well as with Greenland, which is part of the Kingdom of Denmark.
And Trump has certainly drawn all attention to himself once again with these threats, including personal messages with world leaders. What are these text messages?
Well, maybe most famously over the weekend, Trump texted the Norwegian prime minister that because Trump didn't get the Nobel Peace Prize, he no longer feels the need to think, quote, purely of peace, adding that the U.S. should have total control over Greenland. Now, of course, the Norwegian government does not decide who gets that prize. White House spokesperson Anna Kelly elaborated to NPR that Greenland is important for national security and that Trump thinks, quote, Greenlanders would be better served if protected by the United States. That's, of course, certainly not how everyone sees it. In that overnight message from French President Emmanuel Macron that you mentioned, he said at one point, I do not understand what you are doing on Greenland.
A fascinating message, also mixed in some flattery. You're doing a great job in Syria.
Right.
Let's get together for dinner. But this is not the only thing Trump is doing on the world stage. There's also that Board of Peace you mentioned, which is what?
Well, that is something that Trump laid out when he talked about how he wants to solve the conflict between Israel and Hamas. And that announcement, that charter announcement that the White House talked about, is happening on Thursday. We've learned more about that charter recently. According to a copy obtained by NPR, permanent peace will cost nations $1 billion each, and Trump is set to be the permanent chair. And as our colleague Daniel Estrin has reported, the charter says there's a need for a more effective international peace-building body, which makes some fear that the board is attempting to create a rival to the UN. So we're keeping a close eye on that. Russia says Trump has asked President Vladimir Putin to sign on as part of the board. So it's unclear what he'll do and what traditional U.S. allies will do.
Okay, NPR's Daniel Kurtzleben, thanks so much. Really appreciate it.
Of course.
There is growing concern about conditions at the largest immigration detention center in the United States.
And here's why. 3 people have died in custody in the last 6 weeks at a tent camp, which is run by a private contractor. The most recent death happened this past week at the camp located at Fort Bliss in El Paso.
Angela Kocherga with member station KTEP is with us now with the latest. Good morning, Angela.
Good morning, Michelle.
Could you just start with some background on this facility? How big is it and who's sent there?
Yeah, well, the camp has a capacity to hold 5,000 people and it can be expanded. And at the end of last year, the average daily population was about 2,800 people. Advocates and lawyers say that some immigrants picked up in Minneapolis recently are being sent to the tent facility, but people from all over the country are there. The facility is considered a hub for ICE because it's so large and there's a nearby airport for deportation flights.
So tell us about the people who have died at the facility. What do we know about them?
Well, Immigration and Customs Enforcement says 36-year-old Victor Manuel Diaz was found dead last Wednesday. He had been in custody since January 6 when ICE Fed agents, quote, encountered him in Minneapolis and determined the Nicaraguan man was in the country illegally. Now, according to ICE, staff at the detention camp here in El Paso found Diaz unconscious and called for emergency medical help. ICE says the death is a presumed suicide. And earlier this month, ICE reported a 55-year-old man named Geraldo Lunas Campos tried to take his own life, and staff intervened to save him, but he died. Both cases are under investigation. And the third death in custody happened in early December. That was 48-year-old Francisco Gaspar Andres. He died after he was transported to a local hospital for a medical condition.
So the Department of Homeland Security oversees ICE. What does the department have to say about this?
In an emailed response yesterday to a question about medical care at the facility, DHS said it has a long-standing practice to provide comprehensive medical care in custody, and that includes medical and mental health intake screenings within 12 hours of arriving at a facility. DHS said there's also access to medical appointments and 24-hour emergency care.
And what about lawyers or other advocates for the detainees? What do they say about this?
Human rights advocates and multiple lawyers have lots of concerns, and they've documented cases of medical neglect, physical abuse, and unsanitary conditions at the facility known as Camp East Montana. And all of those were included in a report by the ACLU. Marisa Limon Garza is the executive director of Las Americas Immigrant Advocacy Center.
We know from people that we speak with every day at Camp East Montana that they are being denied access to medical attention, whether that's actual medicine or whether that's actual access to a doctor or physician.
And El Paso's Congresswoman Veronica Escobar, a Democrat, toured the facility when it opened in August, and she's calling for it to shut down.
It has never adhered to basic or appropriate standards to ensure the safety and dignity of the human beings in custody.
Escobar is among 122 members of her party supporting legislation to create enhanced oversight for detention centers and phase out private contractors over 3 years.
That is Angela Cochera in El Paso. Angela, thanks so much for your reporting.
Thank you, Michelle.
For more than a century, the Indiana Hoosiers were the punching bag of big-time college football. Those days are over.
Last night, IU completed an undefeated season to win the national championship game 27-21 over the Miami Hurricanes for their first title in school history.
I'm so proud of you for not gloating about that, Steve.
I'm not going to gloat because I follow Purdue. I confess it, but I'm glad for my state.
Okay, well, NPR sports correspondent Becky Sullivan is with us now to tell us more about it. An early morning after a late night. Becky, thank you.
Yeah, good morning.
So is this the biggest turnaround in college football history?
I mean, I certainly think you should make that case. I mean, before this season, Indiana had lost more games in the top level of college football's history than any other school. Not counting last year, they've had only 3 winning seasons in the past 3 decades. Then they hired this guy, Coach Kurt Cignetti. He walked in the door a couple years ago, uttered this iconic line in one of his first press conferences.
Yeah, it's pretty simple. I win. Google me.
And okay. He wasn't lying. He rapidly transformed this program. I mean, I'm not sure what else stacks up to this fast a turnaround. 2 years ago, Indiana went 3-9. This guy walks in the door. Now they are 16-0. Their last 4 wins came against some of the sport's best programs, Ohio State, Alabama, Oregon, Miami. Here he is talking to ESPN on the field after the game.
We won the national championship at Indiana University. It can be done. And I'm so happy for our fans. Words can't describe it.
Rare show of emotion from that one. So, okay, I lack your stamina, Becky, so I only made it to the first half having to get up early. So it was close game, right?
It was, yeah. You know, and Indiana had scored a ton of points in their previous 2 playoff games. This one kind of got off to a slow start, and I was wondering, geez, maybe this Miami defense will be able to slow the Hoosiers down. They have all this NFL talent on their defensive line. They were getting a lot of big hits on the Indiana quarterback earlier. That's Fernando Mendoza. But he ended up being the hero for the Hoosiers tonight. He had 2 key late fourth down conversions in the fourth quarter, including this rushing touchdown where he made this big picturesque leap toward the end zone with the ball outstretched. That put them ahead 10 points and showing what made him the winner of the Heisman Trophy and probably the number one pick in this spring's NFL draft.
As we said, first football title in Indiana's history. How are Hoosier fans taking all this?
I think they're out of their minds. You know, Miami got the ball back down 6 with just about two minutes to go last night. It was their last chance. In the crowd at the game in Miami was so loud that Miami couldn't snap the ball in time. Their own stadium You know, after the game, fans packed Kirkwood Avenue. That's the main drag off of campus in Bloomington. I think Indiana fans just probably thought this was literally never going to happen in their entire lives. How could it even be possible to win, like, the Big Ten with Ohio State and Michigan standing in the way, let alone a national title? But here they are.
So before we let you go, what do you think this says about the state of college football?
Yeah. I mean, I think there's been this transformation in the sport of the last few years that has really paved the way for this run from Indiana. I mean, there's no restrictions anymore or much fewer on players transferring from school to school. Players can earn money now. And so there's been a lot made of, you know, how Kurt Cignetti aggressively was recruiting transfers, more experienced players to come in and make an impact right away. Indiana's also just invested more money into its football program. And it just shows how quickly things can change, how schools that aren't your traditional powerhouses, like Alabama, Ohio State, can suddenly become contenders much more easily before. You know, I'll tell you, Michelle, I'm a graduate of the University of Kansas. That's another school that's way up high on that list of college football's most losses all time. Fans of all sorts of schools are now asking themselves, why not us? So congrats to Indiana fans. I hope you all enjoy it today.
All right. That is NPR's Becky Sullivan. Becky, thank you.
You're welcome.
The voices on NPR today include Michigan's Gretchen Whitmer. The governor of a swing state told Steve that Democrats are expecting President Trump's administration to try to game the results in this fall's midterm elections.
We know that there will be efforts to compromise the election or to dissuade people from showing up, to scare people away, to threaten people. We cannot let that stand. I'm concerned about it. I'd be lying if I said I wasn't.
In an NPR video interview, Whitmer asserted that Democrats are, quote, around the tabletop, unquote, gaming out different scenarios. She said it is not paranoia to think that U.S. troops could be told to play some role.
The comments come from a governor who has tried to work with Trump, occasionally with success. She leads a state that Trump lost in 2020, but then won in 2024. Whitmer is thinking about why Democrats did worse with men, and also why some men seem to be falling behind in society.
I don't know all of the different pressures. I've been studying it. I'm listening to probably a lot of the same podcasts that you are to understand what can we do? How do we bridge this gap? It is real, and I think that's the first step. And the second is really reaching out and listening and making sure that every part of our society can take advantage of opportunities that are available, and we create ones where maybe we need to.
Steve also asked if the country is ready for a woman as president. You can hear Steve's full interview with Governor Whitmer on our radio show Morning Edition. Find it on your local NPR station or watch the video interview on the NPR app.